Morning, sir. How are you, sir?
Aye, I'm John Dogden.
You came, Johnny.
Oh, I took him over and pulled up.
Aye, Mila Gumila John Wakap, Wakai.
Ah, Mendeca, Solid Cup, and as well in the town.
Morning, sir. Johnny.
I'm going to go to the month. Maybe the lockdown rules here have been relaxed, so Mr. Wazan Aliva to Baba.
Ah, after quiet, we're Murupa is still
alive. I know what I'm going to say. It's life, life, you're going to village in. That's how we live. Yeah. We relate in that manner.
Minister, or start?
Yeah, we have to start. Because, but when I did welcome honorable members, members of the committee, finance, deputy minister, DG, officials from treasury, SARS commissioner, officials from parliament. You are all welcome. The purpose of the meeting today is to get a briefing from Treasury and SARS on their preliminary assessment of their performance for the purposes of BRRR. The meeting is officially open. You are all welcome. Alan, are there apologies?
Yes, Chair, from Standing Committee.
Hello,
Alan. You are breaking. Oh, sorry, Chair. I was saying it's only two. It's DA, Jordan Hill Lewis, and FF Plus Boater Vessels. The only two.
Okay. Those are the apologies. And then let's move to item two. Briefing by Treasury on their preliminary assessment of the departmental performance. Honorable Dr. Masondo, Deputy Minister, over to you.
No income, Chair, and thank you, honorable members. May I also apologize because I'm going to leave between 9:30 and 10. But I'll join you again, Chair, for the SARS engagement at 11.
Okay.
So, I'll really appreciate that. So the National Treasury audit 2019-2020, as you are aware, is still underway. Specifically, discussions are continuing with the AG in respect of historical and repeat wasteful expenditure relating to IFMS licenses, support and maintenance, and therefore we'll be presenting the in-year and a draft annual performance and only in-year financial performance report, Chair. As National Treasury, we have achieved 88% of quarter four performance indicators and expenditure amounting to 95% of the budget. Chair, it is also worth stating that 2019-2020 marks the end of the last five-year strategy with National Treasury having achieved an exceptional average of over 80% of the indicators over the last 5 years. We'll continue delivering at this outstanding performance level into the future. As we have previously presented to this committee, we've also updated significantly the 2020-2025 strategy end the 2021 APP to reposition the department to focus on service delivery to meet the needs of the future of the South African economy and fulfill our obligations as National Treasury as set by the South African Constitution. Chair, let me just say two things around the procurement, because our procurement policy regime and system have come under much public scrutiny due to concerns that South Africans have had or continue to have. It is for this reason that one of our focal areas as National Treasury is the modernization and the automation of the public procurement. We are currently processing 4,500 comments that we've received on the draft public procurement bill, and once reviewed, we will commence with another comprehensive stakeholder engagement on the revised bill, because I think we take this bill very seriously. It's a very important tool for transformation, for us also to make sure that we get value for money as we procure goods and services as government. On the modernization of the procurement system, I must indicate, Chair and Honourable Members, that we have released an interactive COVID-19 procurement dashboard on our website. The dashboard provides information regarding the actual commodity purchase, the quantities, as well as the price per item. It enables filtering the data per supplier across all organs of the state. This includes the actual items that have been bought, for example, face masks and other items. It also provides information on the list of names of the directors of companies that have provided COVID-19 related goods and services or works. So this dashboard will also enable us to update data on monthly basis on what we are spending on monthly basis. And I must also say that since going live on Friday, the dashboard has been viewed almost 50,000 times. So people have visited the dashboard, and we can report that almost 50,000 visitors have seen the dashboard or have visited the dashboard. Insofar as the State Bank is concerned, the memo is on its way to the, we are processing the memo for cabinet to consider the options insofar as the State Bank is concerned. And Chair, for a detailed engagement on the National Treasury in-year performance report 2019-2020, let me hand over to the DG and his team to take you through the details insofar as the in-year performance report 2019-2020. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Deputy Minister. Probably before the DG comes in, let me clarify this situation where we find ourselves as to why do we have what they call a preliminary reports instead of final reports, because as you can see there in the package, there is no output, I mean Auditor General's report, so the reports are not complete. We received a letter as chairperson from the House Chair, Honorable Frolic, when was this on the 2nd, in regard to submission of annual reports and assembly program. It says that the Minister of Finance issued the notice in the Government Gazette in terms of that section, which inter alia attempts executive authority, exempts executive authorities from tabling the annual reports and financial statements of the respective departments and institutions within 6 months after the end of the financial year, as set out in the PFMA. These documents are usually tabled by the end of September. Instead, the notice stated that the executive authorities must table these documents within 2 months after the normal deadline, that is by the end of November. These time frames have been extended owing to the lockdown imposed to curb the COVID-19 pandemic. This extension will have an effect on the work and program of the Assembly, especially the consideration of the BRRR and the MTBPS. The Money Act states that the Parliament and its committees must annually assess each department's performance. The BRRR. The Money Act requires that these assessments must inter alia make reference to departmental annual report and financial statements. These assessments are usually conducted in early October. In terms of the MTBBS, the Money Act also states that BRRR must be submitted to the House and, if adopted, conveyed to the responsible minister prior to the adoption of the report on the MTBBS. Owing to this, the Speaker wrote to the Leader of Government Business and the Minister of Finance, in which he asked that annual reports be tabled as soon as possible and that departments must ensure that members have the required information to interrogate departmental performance. In response, the Leader of Government Business requested ministers to prioritize tabling of annual reports, preferably before 16 November. In light of this arrangement, the following process is proposed: proposed procedure and program. 2 weeks, that is the 16th of October, have been set aside for committees to consider departmental performance and prepare BRRR this year. Given the prescripts of the Money Act, however, committees will only be able to conclude their BRRR once the annual reports have been tabled by 16 November. The purpose of this meeting in October will therefore be to conduct a preliminary assessment of departmental performance. Committees are to utilize quarterly reports of the department to scrutinize their performance and financial statements. The government has been asked to assist members and make available the necessary information. The period could also be used to assess in-year performance for the current financial year, especially in light of ongoing COVID-19 related measures and reports. In terms of the draft program, the Minister of Finance is scheduled to table the MTBBS on the 21st of October, after which the relevant sections will be referred to the respective committees. Departments must table their annual reports as soon as possible, and committees must process it without delay. Only those departments with difficult matters to deal with will table by the 16th of October, of November. Committees that are affected by the late submissions of annual reports can meet from 17 to 19 November 2020. Once the BRRR have been tabled, the House will then consider the reports and thereafter the MTBBS. So this is a letter that comes from Mr. Frolic to clarify why we should have this kind of a meeting, even though we don't have statements or audit outcomes from the Auditor General. So this is like a preliminary assessment, but once the statements from the Auditor General are out, they will be consolidated, and then we have a complete report. Thanks very much, DG. You can proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Hello, DJ. There is a problem with your line. Can you hear me? Hello, DJ.
For the opportunity to come into leading our in-air performance. Hello.
DJ. Hello, DJ.
Chair, I can hear you.
Can you hear me now? DJ, can you hear me?
Chair.
Yes. We are struggling to hear you. There seems to be a problem with your line. Check 1, 2. Alan, what's the...
Jay, you are quite audible. It says when the DJ is on, it says his bandwidth is low. So it's a connectivity issue. So that's where we're at. But you are quite audible.
Look, where is he? DJ, can you hear us this side? Deputy Minister, who is challenging?
Laura, are you online? Maybe in the meantime, I can ask you to...
Yes, of course. Would you like me to start the presentation?
Please go ahead. In the meantime, I'll try to get the DG so that we don't keep members waiting.
I don't know what's happening.
Hello? DG, maybe let's ask Laura to start and because we seem to be struggling to hear you.
Laura, I'm in the meeting, but you're struggling to hear me, I'm told.
We are struggling to hear you, DJ. Are you back?
Laura,
can you continue? Laura? Over breath.
Wando, can I continue?
Please go ahead, Laura.
Okay. Thank you so much to the committee, and just to indicate that Starting when the DG can come back on into the meeting, he will address these first three introductory slides. And if necessary, if he's not able to, I will come back to them. So I will specifically focus on the performance of National Treasury. Given that the outstanding component of our audit is focused specifically on the financial component, and the performance audit has been completed, I am going to provide the committee with the draft outcomes of our annual, recognising that there are drafts until our audit has been closed. In terms of our annual draft annual performance, National Treasury achieved 83.33% of our indicators as we had articulated them in the APP, and we did not achieve 16.67%. As previously agreed with this committee, National Treasury presents the final performance as achieved and not achieved, as opposed to partially achieved and not achieved, given that we do not roll over our indicators from 1 year to the next. In terms of quarterly reporting, as we indicated we'd do this at the same time, you will see that over the period, the Treasury generally has an average of in the 80s in terms of performance delivery, with underperformance and not being performed at all. Not performed at all is our key focal area. Given that Treasury does not cumulatively report, each quarter is purposefully and independently reported on, so we particularly track those indicators where we have underperformed, which is identified in the red, but that means we must particularly ensure that we do our next quarter's performance and pick up that which we have not performed. You'll see that we generally have a dip in quarter three. Quarter three is particularly busy for Treasury, and then we lift it back up into quarter four. I have provided the committee with quarter-on-quarter achievements. We do track partially achieved and not achieved. And the reason why we track this is not only to be compliant with the framework, but it's very important. Treasury has increased its planning and reporting ecosystem. And we plan and report at a chief director level, a divisional level, a program level, an APP level, and an NTS level. And we link the performance reporting now to budgeting in a much more stricter and robust way. So it is important for us to look at partially achieved and not achieved, so that then we align to spend and ensure that not only are we delivering, but we're spending the budget in a way that is aligned to perform. We provided the same quarter-on-quarter comparison by division. Remembering Treasury is quite unique in that we don't have a one-on-one relationship between program and division. We have a number of divisions that report to a single program, for example, Budget Office, Intergovernmental Relations and Public Finance, all report into a program three, which is Public Finance Budget Management, for example, and Program 5, which is both the Accountant General and the Chief Procurement Officer. In terms of our annual, we achieved, as I indicated, 83.33% of our indicators. We did not achieve 16.67%, which is combined, partially achieved and not achieved. Effectively, that equates, in terms of number of indicators, we achieved 100 indicators, partially achieved 15, it did not achieve 5. I have provided you with a table where you can clearly see the total number of indicators, where we partially achieved and where we did not achieve. I'll go into the detail now. For Program 1, which is administration, our achievement for this program was 66.67%, and we partially achieved 33.33%. In particular, we completed 97% of our approved risk-based internal audit plan, and slightly less than the 100%. this was attributed both to a resource constraint in the area of internal audit, but also the audits that were scheduled to be completed in the last quarter were affected by COVID-19. We did achieve a saving of 1.8% of the RAND value budgeted for paper usage, travel and strategic sourcing. Those are the three areas we had identified previously as being areas that we could save. It was slightly less than the targeted 2%. We understand that service providers are not in a position, given the challenging economic environment, to negotiate prices, as well as we delay during the course of this year to approval flat until the last possible moment, in case there had been cancellations and we didn't want to pick up fees in terms of cancellation. For program two, which is our economic policy and tax financial regulation, we achieved 91.67% and we did not achieve 8, just above 8%. In terms of our key achievements, committee members, we published 50 papers through our SA TIRE program, key papers that spoke to economic policy matters, looking both at our current economic environment, but most importantly, planning for our future economic pathways. We produced 20 economic models, we maintained 20 economic models, and we produced 4 economic forecasts. We responded to all user requests in terms of economic research as well as policy and scenario modeling, and for commentaries on economic data. In terms of our not achieved, we were delayed in terms of the comprehensive prudential and market conduct framework for new authorities. It was not completed due to a substantial revision following the significant number of public comments we received on this framework. For program three, which talks to our key budget divisions of public finance, budget office and intergov relations, we achieved 85% of our indicators and partially achieved 14.8%. We conducted 50 capacity building initiatives to facilitate improved planning, budget and financial management conduct. This is a key focus area of Treasury going forward. And you will see that this priority area has been lifted up into our APP as well as articulated in the MTSA. We provided a standing committee on appropriations with our 4 quarterly expenditure reports, which is an important part of our monitoring ecosystem in Treasury. We had 100% of the budget facility on infrastructure projects evaluated. As the committee will know, infrastructure is a major priority for our future economic pathway. 26 of our provincial and municipal budgeting benchmark exercises was held to improve provincial and municipal budgeting credibility and composition and achievability. And we delivered 5 support initiatives in provinces, as well as 26 provincial and municipal mid-year budget expenditure performance assessment reports were produced. You can see that the key focal area in this division and this program is around capacity building and intergovernmental relations and, of course, our budget. The areas that we partially achieved is 35 plans were assessed to support infrastructure as opposed to the planned 36. With the underperformance there in respect of responses from departments and entities, 96% of responses to departments' requests for PFMA and TRNR approvals. Again, that is underperformance is attributed to delays in responses from departments. Now, I know the committee has spoken to Treasury before to say that this underperformance is attributed outside of Treasury, given that it's delays in departments. But a number of Treasury's indicators, and these will be perfect examples of them, the RYM feedback reports as well, is that Treasury monitors efficiency indicators, and key parts of our mandate is in terms of a responding or being part of a continuum of service delivery. It's inputs from departments, we consider them, and then, for example, we provide reports to Parliament. We measure the efficiency of our divisions to ensure that we receive those inputs from departments and we receive them on time. And this is the key management tool to ensure that our departments, our divisions are engaging with departments efficiently and effectively and encouraging them to be compliant to the stipulation. Five annual municipal reaching reports were published slightly less than the planned six. In terms of program four, which is assets and liability management, we achieved 71.43%. We have partially achieved 21% and we did not achieve 7.14%. In terms of reviewing corporate plans, annual reports, completing guaranteed applications, reviewing requests for borrowing limits, we achieved 100% of our targets and we reviewed all that we received. We ensured that government annual gross borrowing requirements were met, the interest and redemptions were met, and all government liquidity requirements were met. We only partially achieved the completion of the PFMA section applications received from Schedule 2 and 3B public entities. And this was due to a greater interdepartmental stakeholder consultation required on the application system. And this is a consequence of two things. National Treasury has spent a considerable amount of time, and you will see the outcomes of that process is articulated in our strategic plan that we've already presented to the committee, that we've been focusing on interdivisional relations. To ensure that when the work of one division is being done, they work effectively and engage and consult with other divisions within Treasury, so that the work of public finance, for example, in terms of overview, finds expression in the work that ALM does when they review these kind of intergovernmental requirements and requests. Obviously, and as we increase stakeholder consultation, whether inside the department or outside the department, it will affect the time frames taken because consultation always takes more time. And this resulted in us not achieving some of these indicators within the time frames that we had set, but this was balanced by an increase in the consultations to ensure that all divisions work then come together and consolidate and give a much more comprehensive response to these kinds of reviews. We only had 7 interactions with the rating agencies as opposed to 8, and that was based on the rating agency themselves, which postponed its sovereign credit rating review mission to March 2020. And citing that it was too soon to hold another rating review, given that they had just issued a credit rating opinion in the May of 2019. And only 60% of completed remuneration requests were reviewed. And this was due to the decision made that rather than reviewing each of these requests for executive and non-executive directors' remuneration, rather than reviewing them independently, that a consolidated and therefore a more comprehensive and comparable review would add significantly to the process. So rather than look at each one individually, we held them all back so that a comparison would be made between the different entities and before the decision was made by the minister. In terms of not achieving 22% of the received MFMA submissions regarding tariff adjustments was reviewed within the time frame. They were all reviewed, but these indicators for ALM in particular, they are all legislated. And not only does ALM have to do the revision, but they have to do it within a stipulated time frame. And once again, given that we have now enhanced our interdepartmental stakeholder consultation process, it fell slightly outside of the time given to them. In terms of program 5, we achieved 84.38% of our indicators. We partially achieved 6.25 and did not achieve 9.38. Important work was done in program 5 in respect of support around capacity building, as well as holding people and departments accountable through our forensic investigation, specialized audit reports, and criminal investigation. In terms of that, Treasury produced 50 forensic investigation reports this reporting period, well above the planned 26. We produced 6 specialized audit reports above the planned 4, and we did and continue to support 2 criminal investigation cases above the planned 30. Significant work has been done in this, the committee will know, as we reported in our APP when we presented, that focus is on local government for National Treasury, and we provided significant support by with 17 municipalities being monitored to comply with minimum competency regulations for financial management. 10 municipalities with the highest UISW incurred were monitored to rectify such expenditure. 15 municipalities that received claims and adverse opinions were prioritized for support. And that's an important part of the work that we do. And that work, in terms of monitoring, is further supported by the capacity building work that we do, with 34 training sessions provided to support PFMN institutions on the implementation of Treasury regulations. In terms of OCPO work, we issued 19 instructions in this reporting period. All procurement plans were published on the e-tender portal in terms of National Treasury's priority, as referred to by the Deputy Minister, to strengthen transparency in our procurement space. 32 transversal term contracts were implemented, and 10 departments that were prioritized were supported on supply chain. The functional and technical specifications of IFMS system was not yet developed. There was progress there, however, because of the review of the various procurement options that were available in terms of the new IFMS single design process, it was slightly delayed, but we are expecting to have caught up in this financial year. But significant work has been done in the actual IFMS to catch up on the delivery, as well as on consequence management in the IFMS around the forensic outcomes of the forensic investigation for service providers as well as for individuals. 99.5% of departments' entity deviations and expansion requests were reviewed, as opposed to the 198% of bids were reviewed. Now, the two areas you will see, we focused on this area. We recognize the impact when we are delayed in our review of deviation and expansion requests. So additional resources have been capacitated into this unit through the intervention of the DG, and we are in the process of developing an automated system that will allow departments to lodge these deviation and expansion reports for us to review them and to respond to them. And the system will keep track of the audit trail continuously, with the Treasury now specifically monitoring, as a separate monitoring process, the time it is taking us to respond to deviations and expansions. This work will be supported by the OCPO, who will provide additional support to high users of procurement to ensure that when they do make these kind of requests, the documents from initial presentation are completed, so that we limit that backwards and forwards between the request and OCPO, which obviously lengthens the time. 333 municipal officials were trained, less than 1,000 This was one of the areas that we, one of the few areas that Treasury significantly underperformed in, but that had mainly to do with the fact that LG CETA endorsed fewer learning outcomes for us to then do the planning, as well as there was capacity constraints in the LG CETA, as well as National Treasury. And then in the final quarter, we were affected in terms of lockdown. There was no consolidated annual financial statements for National Department of Public Entities and Auditor Fund, and that was tabled by the 31st of October, and that is due to late submission of audit information by a number of institutions. And the OAG is noting that there is an increased delay in audits in the reporting period, and again, it is noted that there is an increased number of audits that are not completed by 9 months financial. For Program 6, we achieved 100% of our indicators, and critically, all obligations towards international agreements were monitored. We responded to all requests on briefing notes and analysis. We responded to all ad hoc briefing notes. We conducted an intervention to increase South Africa's presence within institutions of strategic value, and we developed an initiative to expand relations with key strategic partners in Africa. In terms of Program 7, this relates specifically to the SLA that is signed between National Treasury and JEPA. We achieved 100% of our indicators, and this has to do with the fact that Treasury has significantly been monitoring the delivery of the SLA and therefore equally Program 7 has more effectively and efficiently administered the benefits program and the service delivery against the SLA indicators. In terms of Program 8, and just the committee to remind the for our, as part of our alignment for National Treasury to fit in our future strategic plans, we have restructured our programs, and Program 8 has been realigned and is no longer part of our program. So this will be the last time we report on Program 8. The work that Program 8 has done has been realigned into other programs where it better fits. And of course, GTAC has their own APP and annual report now, and it does not report as part of National Treasury. We achieved 77.78% of our indicators in Program 8. And this specifically talks to the technical advisors that were placed at National Treasury, provincial treasuries and municipalities, on which we allocated 80 above the proposed plan. 57 catalytic projects were approved in cities and local government areas above the plan 20, and then we report critically on the job site. So 153 projects were approved above the plan 150. We 8927 million grant funding was approved above the planned 7880. Our 177,532 new jobs were contracted above the planned 150,000. 82,000 placements were contracted above the planned 80,000. And 306, almost 307 training opportunities were contracted well above the planned 250,000. 1,208 officials were trained on infrastructure delivery management system. You can see Treasury's focus in support of the economic pathway around infrastructure delivery. 532 graduates were trained for professional registration above our planned 500, and 21 capacity improvement initiatives were undertaken above our planned 800. In terms of our not achieved, 11 programs in integrated zones were planned, slightly less than 12. 9 programs and integrated zones are under implementation, slightly less than the plan 10, and that was due to delays at the actual implementation site. 5037 was grant fund dispersed, slightly less than the plan 5825. And just committee members will remember that there is always a drop-off between the number of the amount that the grant fund plans to disperse and actually disperses, and that's because projects fall out of the process from the project being approved and then the final implementation. And 57.9% response to professional service providers assist with the IDMS less than 100%. This was due to delays in procurement, but the process is back on track in this report. Finally, and then I'll hand over to the DG back in a meeting prior to us going to the finances, but just in terms of a summary of our human capital, Treasury had a vacancy rate of 11.8%, that's higher than Treasury normally has, but as you'll know, there's been a process of Treasury considering the filling of positions and ensuring that they're critical positions that we are filling. Our total staff complement has remained stable, so we have vacancy rates of just over 1,000 staff, of which 88% are Black, 59% are female, and 0.6% of the total staff complement are persons with disability. Of those positions that were filled, 22 were promotions were made from within. 96% of our SMS members entered into performance agreements, and National Treasury vigorously ensured that those who do not sign a performance agreement is not eligible for any performance report. And 38% of our employees participated in skills development and leadership programs, which is less than I have planned. However, this was affected by the fact that Treasury has had a significant amount of additional work to do given the work that we've had to do for COVID-19 as well as budget processes, as well as the fact that we've had vacancies and therefore colleagues have needed to do additional work and may not always have been able to take time for skills development. But we're looking at ways of addressing this in terms of mentorship and in-house skills development. At this point, I'm going to stop and hand back to the DG, and hopefully we've got a better line at DG.
Thanks, Laura. I don't know if members, you can hear me. Apologies. I don't know what's happening with my connection. Are you able to hear me, honourable members?
Yes. Uko Brad.
I know. You must be doing it. Brad actually is better. Connection is much better when I'm... What we did, Laura went through the actual... work that we did, including the achievements. And the first few slides were simply, Chair, just maybe reiterating what we know. We've got 10 programs in terms of the program that we have in the National Treasury, and the last program there, which is Program 10, being basically a transfer where we essentially transfer to state security. It's not actually one of our key programs, but the key for me, Chair, I think is to know the performance. And if you go to the next slide, Laura, I was going to start by saying, Chair, that look, in the period under review, our economic growth has stubbornly remained below what is needed in terms of the target that we've set. We only expanded by only 0.2% compared to 2018. External pressures continue to be faced by this economy. And, you know, global trade has slowed, and, you know, in the midst of uncertainty that the debt levels in many developing countries have risen sharply and are projected to grow, limiting possible responses to shocks globally. And that's a fact that obviously is affecting us. Domestically, pressure, poor electricity continue to be an issue, slowdown in mining and
quarrying, constructions in construction, and low demand and productivity manufacturing as a whole continue to be the hallmarks of this economy. And this is not something that obviously we welcome. Consumption by government expenditure grew 1.5% in 2019. And this obviously with the struggling economy, we saw a huge effect in the fiscal position of the country, which obviously makes it impossible for us to be able to do what we had intended to do. The main budget deficit projection of 4.7 of GDP for 1920 in the budget review grew to 6.9% in the 2020 budget. And you know, it's not a secret anymore that what we said in the supplementary budget was in the double digits of around 14.9%. And obviously we expect that at the medium term budget policy statement will indicate new other numbers in terms of how this economy is probably financed and contracted over time. There are obviously important facts that we have to consider, which is responding to these challenges and making sure that the economy grows by tackling some of the structural constraints that are there and ensuring that we stimulate growth in the economy, restore confidence and public trust, reduce policy uncertainty in many areas. And this remains issues that we have to do, and we have to do speedily so. And again, this is something that we've been saying over and over again, that the key for us is to perform and implement structural reforms that are critical. So the in-year quarterly reports on the progress, reports on the expenditure of national departments and selected public entities provide insight into the use of public funds, thereby improving financial oversight. And then we've done that, we've proven that, although we may not have achieved 100% in other areas, but this is something that we continue playing our role and oversight role in supporting departments, entities, including municipalities. We continue to actually ensure that sound budgetary planning and implementation continues in all spheres of government, including building capacity in other areas, and I think Laura did indicate some of the interventions that you're making. Despite the interventions, we all know that most, especially in municipal areas, there's regression also in terms of general performance of some of these municipalities, which is an area for concern. We continue to ensure that measures to build the transformation of the public of the financial sector continues and advance with a full-blown implementation now of the Twin Peaks regulations, as well as the comprehensive prudential and market conduct framework that we began implementing. And I think we begin to see in the way the FSCA and the way the prudential authority functions, begin to see now results of what we had invested in some time ago. And this is something that's important. Laura did speak about investigative capacity. And Chair, I'm attempting to say, and obviously it's sad for us, we lost in the last few months due to COVID, we lost Daniele Mnyalo. Daniele was the Chief Director of Specialized Audit Services, and she was very critical and instrumental in the OAG, in the Specialized Audit Services. And we hope and believe that with the capacity that's there and left there, we'll continue to make inroads in ensuring that our investigative capacity is maintained or even improved, including support that we're giving to law enforcement agencies, as Laura has indicated, around the support that we give to these agencies. So that program is quite important and it continues to be important. The pipeline that the Treasury has been creating over the years due to budget cuts and many other reasons is beginning to dry up slowly, which is around how we train individuals and how we prepare public servants, especially public finance officials, to actually prepare them for the public sector. We've got a very elaborate internship program. Currently, we've got about 1,600 active municipal interns across 257 municipalities. Our own academy in the Treasury has 30 trainees at any given point, and this number used to be high a few years ago. We continue to produce our chartered accountants, and we produce them generally for the public sector and for the private sector, and we think it's something that we need to continue, including our own internal internship program. As I say, over the years, that program has been scaled back because of budget constraints and budget cuts. But it's something that I think as we move on, we have to focus on in ensuring that we actually create this important pipeline that will ensure that, experience and skills remain in the public sector around public finance. We will continue to work tirelessly to build partnerships and diligently maintain stakeholder relations to optimize the impact that we have on the jobs fund, including the work that we do on the city support program and generally support to municipalities, including the neighborhood development partnership development grant, which provides support to municipalities in specially targeted areas, and also that fund for catalytic projects that contribute to socioeconomic transformation, including growth that attract investment in the precincts in our own localities. This is a very important program, and we continue making inroads in this program. And we think, because here we partner with municipalities, we think we should, in the next few years, ensure that this program expands in a way that we have to expand it. But yeah, just generally, and the last point I want to make is that we continue, amid difficult challenges, we continue to keep our heads above the water as National Treasury, as officials, and keeping, despite the poaching, call it that, by officials, by some of our officials, by the private sector, we continue to losing people, as Laura indicated around our human capital. It's important that, Chair, we keep our heads above the water in ensuring that we keep the skills in the treasury. You'll see in the next financial year, we'll be reporting that we've lost a few key individuals who have either been lost to international organizations, or we've lost them to other government departments, which we welcome, by the way, if they don't leave the is much, much bigger than it used to be. Every continue calling us, they expect us to second our people. So we are stretched, Chen. But however, I should be able to say that above all of the challenges that we face now, the treasury staff remain intact, the treasury staff remain motivated in ways that, it's unbelievable. And that's the chance. The last point I wanted to make, just making sure that despite all that we read, despite all that we see, we are in there, we are keeping the finances of the country intact, and we are keeping the management thereof intact. Thank you very much, Chair. We'll be more than ready to take any questions and comments from members. Thank you.
DJ.
Thank you, Chair.
Are you done with the presentation?
Yes, we are done with the presentation, Chair.
Okay. Okay, Deputy Minister, DG, Laura. That's the presentation, honorable members. Can we engage with the presentation? Clarity, speaking questions, comments. Alan, you'll assist me in identifying members who want to speak. I see Honorable Dr. George. Who else? Murulung. Who else? And then, those are the three for now. Honorable Dr. George.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks very much from the Treasury for the presentation. Very interesting as usual. I just have two questions, really. The first question relates to pension fund reform. I know we're looking at the targets, etc., and the performance of the department, but it is completely silent on that. Now, if it doesn't reside there, then the question is, where does it reside? We know that for several years there's been this issue around reform of the system. It's obviously quite a long process, so it does take a long time, and there has been some movement towards it. But I'd just like to know from the Treasury, where they are in terms of that long-term program. That's the one thing. And then the other question is, and I'm sure we're going to see from SARS shortly, is that, I mean, as much as we know, we don't have specific targets necessarily on tax collection, but it is very clear that there's going to be an enormous reduction in the amount of tax collected for this year, given the pandemic. And obviously the National Treasury needs to respond in some way, because even though we've got the loan, that money is not going to be sufficient to plug all the holes that we've got, especially also discuss the issues of corruption, but that's really a side issue for now. But the question then to the National Treasury is that how are they factoring that in? Because, I mean, it is all good and well to meet a target, perhaps the previous target that was set, etc. But we know what is coming down the track. And I think that's a very important concern for everybody in South Africa, given how much we're going to see the economy receding already.
Dr. George, are you having a connectivity challenge?
No, Chair. I don't know if that was clear. I seem to be on, but thank you. I'm done. Was that not clear, Chair?
It was clear on our side, Chair. I was able to pick up all the questions.
Thank you.
Dr. George, are you done? You got disconnected at some stage.
No, Chair. The Director General did get my question. Thanks, Chair. I am done.
Okay. Thanks. Honorable Murorong from Swaziland.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me apologize for not putting my video on. I've got serious connectivity challenges. Look, I wanted to know what is the Treasury plan to address the vacancy rate in the light of the pandemic. Two, we have vowed in the past that the National Treasury will provide liquidity technical support to municipalities. It is quite clear that our municipalities are in a debilitating state. The audit outcomes speak volumes about the state of our municipalities. I wanted to find out whether we have been able through National Treasury to dispatch a team to provide that requisite technical support to municipalities. I see that there's been monitoring with respect to compliance on minimum competency regulations for financial management. But of course, we are concerned with the state of the municipality. We are also concerned that all types of interventions that are put in place must be able to yield the requisite results. Chairperson, just to deflect a little bit from the report, I wanted to find out what is the National Treasury position on the extension of the special COVID relief grant funding. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Murolo. Kotan.
No, thanks. Honorable Chair.
You are having a challenge
and greetings to honorable members and the. Okay, am I audible?
Yeah, switch off the video. I think you will be.
Can you hear me now?
Now you are well, you are loud and clear now.
Okay. No, thanks, Chair, and greetings to yourself, the Deputy Minister, and all honorable members, and the team of the National Treasury, as led by the DG. I think Honorable Murolong partly covered me, because I saw that on program A, Ms. Laura indicates that the achievement rate is about 77.78%. However, in relation to technical advisors, I think they are indicating that there are about 80 technical advisors that were placed at National Treasury, Provincial Treasury, and also at municipalities through the program of the MFIP to assist with issues of finances and stuff like that. And in terms of their projection, they were supposed to at least appoint 60, but they have appointed 8, which is a very good thing, I think, to assist provinces and municipalities on issues of finance and audit and stuff. So my question is, do you see any positive results because of that particular program? Because I think it's a common knowledge that our municipalities are not performing well in terms of audit. So since this program of having these technical advisors being dispersed to municipalities, is there any improvement thus far? Or are we going to see the improvement perhaps in the following year? Or are there any positive results currently when you compare with the previous years? Because I think from the layman's person's point of view, I think what we know is that municipalities are not performing as expected in terms of audit. The second question with regard to human capital, I can see that the vacancy rate in terms of staff complement is very low at 11.8%. It's very low. And also, I think the staff complement in terms of demography, I think it's well represented. But now in terms of people with disability, I see that you've got only 0.76% of people with disability, which is less than the required percentage. So I want to know, what is the difficulty there? Are you unable to get people with the requisite skills who've got disabilities, or what is the problem? Because often the government is always challenged by associations and organizations that represent people with disabilities, that the government is not employing them, yet the government is expecting private sectors and other people to employ them. So I want to know, what is the challenge of not having the required percentage of people with disability who are staff complement? Thanks, Honorable Chair.
We are talking about concern. Those are the three questions and comments for now. Deputy Minister, DG, and your team, over to you.
No, thank you very much. Sir, can I say something
about that? No,
sir. Yes, sir.
Ugo, who's that crowd?
I'm in the bushes in King William Town, and I got cut off at some point. I'm sorry, I apologize for that.
Okay, you can come in.
Okay, Chair. Thank you so much. Chair, what I want to first and foremost greet everybody, starting with the Deputy Minister, and I will head on to your protocol in terms of all the questions. Chair, I think what you outlined at the beginning, after the Minister has spoken, is quite critical for process. So I think maybe, if possible, you could probably share that with us, so that we do not, at the end of the day, blame you for taking us in a particular direction, if you understand what I mean.
No.
And then, secondly, Chair, the Deputy Minister mentioned the state bank bill. And as you all know, that one has long been outstanding, and therefore, if you could just stick to the time frame in terms of that, when can we expect it in Parliament? Where is the process right now? I think, Chair, there was in the presentation by the DG something on electricity. And I think it it might be partly their responsibility, but partly not. But if they could just open their hearts to us in terms of what their long-term plan is regarding electricity in the country generally. What is it that is in the pipeline that will ultimately deal with the problem? And lastly, Chair, lastly, I hear that there's been some spending, which is good, on ensuring that there is empowerment amongst the youth, especially when it comes to
hello, Noxin. Honorable Abrams, cutting. Okay, I think we'll allow her to continue once she got connectivity. But for now, let's have the DG and his team responding to the questions and to the questions asked so far.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the question. Let me take a few, and colleagues will also come in. Just around specific targets in terms of collections. Obviously, we did indicate at the time of the supplementary budget that we've under-collected by 304 billion at the time. Obviously, as we speak now, that's why some of my team members are not in this meeting. As we speak, there's a revenue analysis working committee meeting between the SARS, the Reserve Bank, and various units in the Treasury, trying to actually understand the revenue performance. And obviously, the commissioner later on will talk a little bit about some of this stuff here. But we obviously expect that we will under-collect. We are factoring in that under-collection in terms of our numbers moving forward. But as one can imagine, we've got two options. The deficit, as I said in my presentation, increased in the numbers that we indicated in February compared to what we said at the supplementary budget. And I said we are talking a double-digit deficit number, based essentially on the performance of the economy and the under collection. So we are factoring this in on our jobs in terms of how we look at this thing moving forward. In areas where, moving forward in terms of budgets, obviously we will consider reducing some budget. We will reconsider expanding, stopping some programs. We will, make sure that we actually ensure that efficiency gains are exercised in one way or the other to ensure that we still are able to perform the functions as planned, but also ensuring that we understand that, the economy is not performing well, and that's the direct implication in terms of what is collecting. Now, our vacancy rate on our rolling, we continue losing people to the private sector, financial services, because what one has realized, the Treasury has become a very good hunting ground for many companies in South Africa, with the kind of people that we attract and the kind of people that we train and the skill that they acquire at the Treasury. So it's much sought after, and then so we continue to like, if you looked at just this past weekend, we advertised about 8 different digital positions, all chief special audit services, different directors in the economic modeling side, in the financial services side. So we continue to advertise, we continue to look from within. We did get 22 people promoted internally because, as I said, our pipeline and our internship program has been robust in the last few years. So there is a capacity, obviously, to take people from within, but it's very challenging to actually address the vacancy rate that we have, and to ensure that we are able to provide support. Now, you specifically asked questions around support that we give to municipalities. And we've got the Municipal Finance Improvement Program that has been with us for a while, aiming essentially at making sure that we provide support to municipalities. And as I said in my earlier input, that despite the support that we give, we see the audit outcomes, assets audit outcomes, negative audit outcomes that we see. So clearly, the program is, you know, bearing fruit here and there, but we really have to relook at how we support municipalities. The whole municipal finance support program, we've revised it within the Treasury. We are giving dedicated support and ensuring that we're able to intervene as per required by the MFMA in the way that we do. So it's something that we'll continue doing. Now, in terms of extending the COVID relief grant, currently that's not an issue that we are, that's on our radar screen. We are not, as Treasury, we can only act within the context of what the Minister's Committee on the Budget and the Cabinet and the policy framework. The current arrangement is the support that we gave during COVID, and that support is coming to an end in October, as we indicated. There are no plans to expand that, as far as I know, but if that has to change, we will at the appropriate time announce that. But as I say, the relief package is definitely coming to an end as per the original intention, as announced at the time of the budget earlier in the year, that this support will be until October. The electricity environment, as correctly honourable member, you did indicate that it may not be directly our responsibility. Clearly, the Department of Energy and then with the new IPP program and with the new capacity and the ESCOM and the reform program that ESCOM is currently embarked, all of those things can only mean positive aspects in terms of how the electricity sector is being reformed, including new capacity that the Minister of DMR announced the other day in terms of access and new capacity that's needed and what exists is going to be. So we will continue to support, as you know, from a budget point of view, we are supporting ESCOM in meeting targets. There's a support package that is factored in the budget for ESCOM, 23 billion rand a year, 46, and this will continue as planned. So in our case, we will continue supporting, but expect that the sector actually reforms itself and actually ESCOM performs in a way. Let me also give Laura Chair the opportunity and others who are on the call to just respond to some of the aspects that I may have left out. Laura, please come in.
Thank you. So just in terms of the vacancy rate, I did want to indicate that a National Treasury will be filling some of our key and SMS positions. So we have been able to take that process forward, and the CAP and the memo in that regard has on its way to Cabinet. In terms of the technical support to municipalities, as the DG has indicated, this is a particular priority area for Treasury. And we are undergoing a process of organisational review. And part of that is to consolidate areas around our support to municipalities so that we can provide a guarantee, increased support and leverage. We are also using that very particular MFIB as our pilot. Treasury is starting a new assessment process around value-added assessment. This is a new monitoring stream for us. It's not simply monitoring against performance or against budgets, but it's actually going to be monitoring the value-add that these large projects do that are being implemented over a long period of time. And we're starting with input. So that will, that review will definitely be able to confirm that question. In terms of disabilities, the committee is absolutely correct. We have not been able to achieve our target consistently in terms of disability. And there seems to be a gap between our needs in terms of the recruitment and the response to our recruitment efforts in this area. And Treasury is focusing on how to address this gap. between calling for recruitment in terms of persons with disabilities and us to getting the applicants coming forward. Finally, two questions. One, in terms of pension fund reform, just to indicate that it can get, in terms of the long-term process, as was requested, engagements with organised labour continue to be underway on that matter. Finally, when it comes to National Treasury, because as you will know, the National Treasury not only looks at government-wide matters, as a department we are also affected by decisions that Treasury makes. So in terms of the reduction of budget for Treasury, as we have indicated to the committee when we came with our change of type APP and our SP, we maintain our position that SP, we have made no changes to our strategic plan, no changes to three of our indicators in terms of our APP. It's a big ask. It's a big ask of Treasury. We are expecting them to do a lot more with a lot less, both in terms of person resources and budget resources. But we are committed, as Treasury colleagues are committed to deliver on all of our indicators, because there's a recognition that the work that we do is critical during normal times, and specifically critical during these times as we are addressing the dual impact of the COVID-19 and long-term economic challenges. Thank you, Treasurer. DG, I'll hand back to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I can't think of any other question unless if Chair, you know, you want to take another round from the members. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, DG, and your team. There doesn't seem to be follow-up questions or new questions being raised. I mean, new hands being raised. I think we should move to the next item. Let's invite the SARS Commissioner to brief the committee on their preliminary assessment of their performance. Commissioner?
Good morning, Chair and members, and my colleagues at Treasury. Chair, I am welcomed by a number of the senior colleagues from SARS, but I won't take the time now to introduce them separately, but in question time, I may refer some questions to them. Let me just share my screen with you, Chair. Or actually, it says the host must share the screen. So we have sent a presentation.
Sorry, Commissioner. Commissioner, it's Alan. I will make you a co-host and then you can
produce. Please, that will help, yeah. Okay. Chair, while that's happening, so thank you for the opportunity to engage the committee, and we always value the feedback from the committee. Just maybe as a introductory comments, Chair, you may recall when we presented a year ago, I indicated that we needed to make a shift in the things we measure at SARS for a number of reasons. So allow me just to share you what shifts we are currently in the process of making. The first is to shift from measuring input measures to impact, output and impact measures. So for example, there is very little value if SARS tells you it is going to perform 100 audits and then a year later come and tell you we have performed 100 audits and we tick ourselves the box and we pat ourselves on the back. The real question you should be asking is, what is the impact of those performance? What did it achieve? And many of our measures in the previous 5 years were very significantly input rather than impact measures. So that's the first shift that we want to advocate and share with the committee, which I signposted a year ago. The second is many of the measures are transactional measures and not necessarily transformational measures or strategic measures. Part of the work at an organization such as SARS, which has huge societal impact, is about rebuilding SARS. It is about improving the strategic clarity. It is about building the employee engagement, changing the culture. None of those things are necessarily always eloquently reflected in a scorecard, yet that is the underlying work of rebuilding an institution. The third is there is a need for an organization such as SARS to be more agile and responsive to those things which could not have been known or fully understood at the time of planning. I mean, this year is a great example of our need to have responded to COVID, and COVID was never anywhere in our plan. But this year it's COVID. Every year there is something. One of the examples I can share with you is our response to the illicit trade in the previous year was never adequately reflected in the APP, yet we have to do it. We have to step up our collaboration with our sister agencies in an attempt to stem the tide. And we can tell you now, we are still not winning that war, as I will talk about later on. But that's not known at the time of planning. And lastly, Chair, in that regard, the ultimate measure of SARS's performance is not necessarily the number of audits it does or the number of seizures it intervenes. The ultimate measures of SARS is, one, the revenue collection, the performance of the revenue collection against the nominal GDP growth. We refer to that as the buoyancy factor. The second important measure for SARS is the cost to revenue ratio. How much did it cost for every rand that we collect? The third is an overall improvement in compliance trends, because that has a more enduring impact on and more sustainable impact on future revenues. And the fourth is the trade facilitation. So I share that as background, and I guess I'm also making a case for the committee that it's not only relevant to SARS, I think it's relevant to many of the departments, but very, very relevant to SARS. We seek the committee's understanding and insights on those things that transform the organization and shifts it away from measuring stuff that we do to measuring the impact of the stuff that we do. Should I just share that by way of an introduction? So let me get to the presentation, Chair. If I can just confirm that the members can see the presentation, Chair.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
We can see the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. So I want to share with the committee just the context of last year. So the first part of my presentation will be the review of our performance last year. I have to also, as indicated to you, Chair, that in our case, the reason why we have not distributed the physical annual report is because we have not had it signed off yet by the Auditor General. But the results mostly will be unchanged. The results I share with you in this presentation is largely the result that we will report in our annual report. But the annual report is not yet ready for public consumption. I thought that was also an important point to make up front. But I will share with you the performance, and then also in the second half of my presentation give you an India update. So Chair, last year the country, as Treasury indicated, continued to experience significant economic challenges. We were in a steady contraction of the economy, and that has a direct impact on the revenue that we collect. Secondly, SARS found itself, as all of the committee members are aware, in a period where it needed to respond to the unfortunate, having become an unfortunate casualty of the state capture, and the work of rebuilding has begun, but as I indicated, will take substantive effort and time and resources from National Treasury. Internally, we have commenced, but still have a long way to go with improving the staff morale. But I have to say that I am encouraged every day by the many men and women of SARS who have remained committed to serving the higher purpose. And then, as I pointed out, rebuilding SARS requires a focus away from some of the short-term tactical measures to more longer-term strategic measures. In the past year, therefore, a few important projects were initiated. The first is we needed to address issues of governance, integrity, and reputation. The committee will be aware that at the very senior level, we have done so. We have taken leave of some senior executives. One of those matters is still unresolved. And then more lower in the organization, we have initiated a listening campaign. We have had to address a number of issues that came up in the Nugent report and was also widely reported in the media. I can give the committee the assurance that even though that doesn't appear anywhere on an APP, we are encouraged by the progress we are making there. Building leadership competencies, we have removed the original senior level of leaders within SARS and are slowly re-engaging with a broader team of leaders, the top 16 instead of just the top 12. We have begun some meaningful investment in leadership development. We have clarified what are the acceptable leadership attributes and competencies that is acceptable for a SARS leader. That will form the basis of recruiting leaders, the basis of investment and developmental programs for leaders, as well as the basis of performance evaluation for leaders. And I lead that work personally because it is one of the most important components of the commissioner's work, is to ensure that the leadership capability and integrity is secured for now and the future. We have also, as reported earlier, identified a very focused work stream with the help of Judge Davis, but using SARS resources as well as some individuals that the minister has approved. And that work is nearing its completion, and we will soon be sharing that work with the minister and subsequently with the committee, because our revenue recovery program and rebuilding compliance is ultimately what is going to improve the fiscal integrity of South Africa. Borrowing more money is not the way that we will recover our fiscal integrity. It is ultimately closing the revenue leakages, both from aggressive planning by corporates and wealthy individuals, as well as addressing the illicit and criminal activity and the extent to which that robs the country of its revenue. So a huge focus for us on that. Also, that doesn't appear on our APP. Then strengthening organizational capability, as I said earlier on, this is a huge challenge for us. Of the almost 2,000 technical people that have left, we are struggling to fulfill this, partly because of a lack of funding, but secondly also, these are highly skilled resources that are not as abundantly available as one would hope, and we also need to improve SARS as an employer of choice. So let me just say our highlights, Chair, for last year is that, as I said, the ultimate indicator of our performance is how well we have collected revenue, and I am pleased to say that notwithstanding the relative under-recovery against the estimate, SARS collected a year-on-year growth of 5.3% versus an economy that expanded by only 4.6%. The committee will remember the planning assumption when the initial target was given by the minister or estimate was given by the minister was that the economy will grow more than 7%. I'll come back to that later. And in fact, the economy only grew around about 4.5%. The Nugent Commission's recommendations have been substantively implemented. Our inbound query volumes have declined by 20%. That is a function of the outbound quality of work, and so that decline is encouraging, but we still have a long way to go, so we will not declare victory. Our taxpayer complaints is down by 30% year-on-year. Again, is a function of the quality of the outbound work and the engagement with taxpayers proactively. You will recall that VAT refunds was a big issue. It was an issue that also eroded some public confidence. I'm very pleased to share with you that we have reduced the VAT turnaround time without compromising quality. In fact, we have improved the quality of that work through data management and artificial intelligence. We've reduced that from around about 28 days to just over 18 days. This year, but also partly because we commenced the work last year, we really took auto assessment, which is a new feature which we trialed in the last financial year, but stepped it significantly up this year, and I'll report on that separately. But a huge success on our journey towards our strategic intent of voluntary compliance. Very pleased to share with the committee that our e-channel usage is up 70% against what we targeted at 55%. Our uptime for e-channels, which is a function of the integrity of our systems and the support work by SARS and its maintenance partners, is over 99%. We have had 5,832 custom seizures, partly because of risk profiling ahead of time, reviewing of manifests, looking at reconciliation between documents, profiling importers and travelers, but also on-the-spot vigilance by our customs officers results in those seizures. The sum of our compliance interventions, which is everything from raising and collecting an assessment, recovering debt, entering into other agreements by taxpayers, reversing structures that may have been aggressive, and collecting the revenue has yielded just more than 100 billion, and SARS scorecard achievement overall is 78.2%. So those are the highlights, which really in one page gives you a sense of how SARS has translated the resources and the human effort into impactful outcomes. Mindful just of our volumetrics, useful to see, and I will give the committee members just a moment to look at it. On this page we have new registrations, tax returns that submitted, the number of taxpayers we served, payments. And so you can see it is a huge quantity of transactional volumes that we have to process, including over 8 million calls, both inbound and outbound, over 19 million payment transactions, over 6.5 million, or rather 5 million taxpayers that we serve in our branches, and 17.5 million taxpayers return that we have processed. So a significant amount of volume that we process. I think pleasing here is that last year when we ran the pilot, we had 228,000 auto assessments that were accepted, and you'll see the significant improvement in that when I share with you the in-year performance. And the number of complaints, as I said, dropping by 31% also means that we are working hard to resolve matters proactively before they become taxpayer complaints. But again, as I said, it's early days. We will be hesitant to declare victory in this regard. This is a view of customs. The 5,800 seizures that I referred to earlier has an estimated value of 2.4 billion rand. And so you can see these are significant interventions that translates into revenue, but also creates the kind of vigilance and alertness at our ports of entry. You can see that almost half of that was counterfeit goods, with a huge concern in areas such as narcotics and cigarettes and tobacco products. Just to come back to the economy, therefore, Chair, as I said, when the minister in February 2019 gave the estimate for SARS, the assumption of GDP growth nominally was 7.6%, which was a real growth of 2% and an inflation of 5.5%, where it ended. And on the back of that, the assumption was that we should produce 1.4 trillion rand. What actually transpired is a real economic growth of 10% of the 2%, i.e. 0.2% inflation, slightly lower than what was predicted. So a nominal growth in the economy of only 4.6%, against which SARS then collected 1.35 billion rand, or some 5.3% growth, which is better than what the economy did. The economy was characterized by poor economic conditions, public debt that has and continues to rise, which should be a concern for all of us, poor performances from SOEs, and in fact, some SOEs have become huge drain, not only a huge drain on state resources, but they also then penalize the state in two additional ways. Firstly, they are not necessarily producing tax revenue that that would normally be expected from well-performing SOEs, and the state also is therefore not able to collect a dividend from these SOEs. So the impact of underperforming SOEs cannot be understated. Electricity supply reliability has a direct impact on the quality of the economy and therefore the quality of tax collection, and business confidence when it is in decline also means fewer investment decisions, fewer jobs that are created, and the tax base fundamentally that shrinks rather than being expanded. So we can see the entrenched structural issues that is not only holding the economy back, it also is have a direct impact on the health of the revenue collection. In terms of jobs, that is increasingly a huge concern. We have seen an increase in the number of retrenchments, lower wage settlements, and reduced bonus payments, which clearly is also an impact on discretionary income for consumption, which translates into lower VAT collection, lower jobs, which translates into lower personal income tax, lower company profits, which translates into lower company taxes, lower imports, lower exports. And so you can see that SARS is directly linked to the well-being of the economy or otherwise. We've seen a increase, as I said, of almost 50,000 additional tax directors for entrenchments. You know, employment taxes continue to be under pressure. In terms of business rescues, I think it is important of the impact is SMMEs. So of the 230 business rescue applications in the year under review, 221%, in fact, most of them, in fact, relates to SMMEs. And of the 3,480 liquidation applications, 3,490 relates to SMEs. So we can see that the huge casualties in this regard are those who create self-employment, and unfortunately, this also has a huge impact on revenue collection. The revenue performance, we thought we'll just give you a quick highlight of revenue collection since 2013. The light blue is the revenue that was collected versus the revised estimate is the dark blue. And I have to also say for a number of these years, this was impacted by, unfortunately, an inefficient VAT, inefficient refund system. So the revenue performance in the earlier years reflects also a higher than what would normally be expected. That thankfully has been addressed since 2018, and I'm pleased to say that as far as we are aware or know, there is no irregularity in terms of the way we deal with refunds. Chair, I'm going to go pretty fast through this. These are just a view of the different taxes and the percentage to which they contribute. You can see there almost 40% of our tax collection is still through the pay-as-you-earn system or individual taxes, and then followed by consumption taxes. So the health of our revenue system is significantly a function of employment and consumption. The fuel levy that you see later on at 6% is in fact also a reflection of consumption. The tax buoyancy, as I said, which is a real indicator of the performance of a revenue administration, you would want that number to be bigger than one. The long-term average of SARS over the prior period was about 1.08. Last year it was 1.16. And the tax to GDP ratio is also an OECD measure that holds as an underlying assumption that if you extract too much tax out of the economy, then you may have a short-term increase in taxes in absolute terms, but you do not leave enough money in the economy to create a future revenue tax base and future revenue activity. And so our long-term average is around about 24%. A 26.3% in this case is more a reflection of a poor performing economy than an outperforming revenue collection. This is just a view per tax type that you can see there that PIT has increased by 40%, but that is mainly driven by policy choices, fiscal drag that has been reduced. In other words, not adjusting for inflation has kept PIT contribution higher. And for the rest, the performance against the other tax factors was fairly pedestrian. Chair, debt is a huge challenge for SARS. Firstly, because there is need for a huge review of the way we account for debt, as well as the way we manage the entire debt value chain from the collection, from the raising of an assessment through to the collection thereof. 2 points that I want to make in this regard. The first is that the debt book, which currently stands in the year under review at 177 billion, we are this year working towards, over the next 2 to 3 years, migrate from the current system of cash accounting. In other words, we account for the money in the bank. We have to move towards an accrual basis of accounting, which is the money that needs to be recognized whether or not you have collected it. That adjustment in itself will have a huge impact, and at some point in time we may need to spend some time with the committee and do a short presentation on what it means to move from cash basis of accounting to an accrual basis of accounting in terms of the Accounting Standards Board. So that's the first point. And the second point is we are currently this year piloting a different way of allocating and managing debt, and we will be able in the future to give the committee some report against that. But suffice it to say, there's a huge opportunity for us to improve the way we manage our debt. So I just want to register that as a concern that I have and that shared by the executives on the line. Chair, this is just some very quick overview of the outcomes. Some of this I've shared earlier on. The 5,800 seizures, the 1,200 excise clients translating into a revenue of 2.4 billion, and the audits contributing to 1.2 billion of that. So again, as I said, what is important is not the 1,221 audits necessarily, but whether it has translated into revenue that has been collected and whether there has been an improvement in compliance. Our program two is one where I want to register with the committee a huge concern of a historic decline in compliance trends. This is both a combination of a growing decline in tax morality and tax compliance by taxpayers, but also a SARS that is not optimally performing in this regard. I also want to say that these targets were set as aspirational targets, and unless one can translate an aspirational target into a clear operational plan and allocate resources, then those targets are pie in the sky. So I don't believe that at the time when these targets were set, the true operational realities were taken into account. But that notwithstanding, it is still a huge concern that our actual compliance rates are so low. And that's probably the area of my biggest concern at the moment. In terms of increasing ease and fairness of doing business, you can see the improvement, as I've pointed out earlier, of the average turnaround time for VAT has significantly improved. Our customer satisfaction in the contact center, just over 90%, and over 99% systems uptime is indeed positive, and I think a very pleasing result that we went from 55% e-filing in the previous year to over 70% in the year against which we are reporting. An area that we clearly still need to work hard on is the resolving of taxpayer queries within the turnaround time. And so even though there is an improvement in that, we still have a lot of work to do in that regard. In outcome four, where we said increased cost effectiveness, this is not a good story. SARS has seen a steady decline in its allocation, and this will impact on the ability of SARS to perform its mandate. Now, whilst it is understandable that the whole of government is resource constrained, SARS would argue very strongly that you cannot deal with SARS as if it is a cost center. SARS is in fact a revenue center, and therefore the allocation of resources to SARS is an investment in the fiscal framework and the integrity thereof. And so one cannot have a short-term view on resource allocation to SARS. A good benchmark for revenue performance is around about 1%. In an area where there is the need for significant investment, one would expect that to drift up to 1.1 or even higher. SARS in the last year received 0.78% of an allocation, which is significantly underfunded. We have raised this point with the Minister and our colleagues in Treasury, but it remains a concern. Then in terms of increased trust and credibility, we are stepping up our efforts to deal with internal fraud, but still a huge area of concern. You will recall that we have re-established our anti-corruption unit in SARS and our integrity unit, and that work will continue. On the voluntary disclosure program, I want to register that notwithstanding the fact that we completed 2,183 applications, and through that collected 3.8 billion rand, we have to do more and we have to do better, and we have to create a higher level of confidence so that more taxpayers who are currently non-compliant in fact choose to become compliant in a way that is voluntary. This then means that we don't have to go out and find them. They come to us and they basically disclose to us that they have areas of non-compliance. In terms of the acquisition spend, we did reasonably well with business to black-owned entities, and 3% of our spend to qualifying small enterprises and 3% to micro enterprises. But I have to say also the reduced spending has also limited the opportunity for SARS. The most significant component of our spend is not discretionary, because there are either in terms of fixed long-term costs and leases or staffing costs and multiple year maintenance service contracts. Also against our service charter, I think whilst we are doing okay in certain areas, particularly in terms of branch visits and contact centers, and e-filing channels. We still have to do better in terms of finalizing within 2 business days where there is no inspection required, and 21 business days where inspection is required. A huge area that shows up internal inefficiencies in SARS, but also under resources. And then I think overall we need to ensure that we consistently perform against. This current service charter is under review, and we will engage the committee once a new service charter has been approved. Stakeholder management is important for us. This is just a slide that gives you a sense of the broad range of stakeholders that we work with. And this, you will recall, is an explicit instruction by us, an explicit objective by SARS, recognizing that we cannot improve the overall revenue performance and compliance unless we work with and through these stakeholders. And it is of such an important impact that we have made this an explicit strategic objective for the next 5 years. People, we are down from 12,700. You will remember this number has steadily come down from over 14,000 in 2014, and it is now approaching 12,000. This is not necessarily a good picture, because in this reduction, our core competencies in highly important technical areas that we have not been able to replace because of funding constraints and the cost reduction that is imposed on us. We think that at the moment there is at least between 600 and 800 vacancies that are critical but unfunded. In terms of governance, Chair, needless to say, we have gone through enormous changes. Some of it destabilizes the organization in the short term, but hopefully brings about stability and credibility over the long term. And this work will continue. But we have to say we cannot achieve this without the commitment from our colleagues in National Treasury. To ensure that SARS is adequately funded. The financial information, this is the subject, as I said, of final sign-off by the auditors, so I won't spend too much time on that. Very quickly, some forward-looking stuff. We've shared this with the committee, the vision 2024 to build a smart modern SARS with unquestioned integrity, trusted and admired. Our 9 strategic intent that is now the plank on which we are building a different journey which is more transformational, less transactional, but also more adaptive as the environment changes. The wisdom of long-term 5-year planning cycles in a world that is increasingly agile, unpredictable, and disruptive requires a different, more agile and more responsive approach to planning. It doesn't mean no planning, it just means a different philosophy and approach to planning. So just very quickly, we were declining in the economy, working along steadily, and along came a little invisible virus that changed our life fundamentally. How do we respond? First of all, I think it was important for us to make sure that taxpayers throughout this time were enabled to continue to fulfill their obligations. And we did this by ensuring that the regulations accommodated for SARS as an essential service. This was important. You may know that SARS, in terms of the broader Labor Relations Act, was not identified for some reason as an essential service. I think COVID has has highlighted to us how essential SARS in fact is. And so thankfully the regulations allowed for that. We also had to work with double quick time to implement the relief measures. Remember, the relief measures is simple as policy statements, but when the rubber hits the road, taxpayers want a system that implements this easily, and so SARS had in double quick time had to adjust, align and adapt our systems to administer these relief measures. We had to reconfigure the way we work with our staff. In the first week post-lockdown, our productivity levels dropped to 13%, and we had to work very hard to enable our staff and to make more of them available, allow more of them to work from home, to where we are now above 90%. We also had to step up the use of technology and data. Fortunately, this was in line with our strategic intent, so it was just accelerating that work, allowing more people to work remotely, but also more taxpayers to fulfill their obligations offline. We had to stop these long queues, and so we introduced an appointment-only system for taxpayers who desperately wanted to come to our branches, but as far as possible, we discouraged taxpayers from coming to the branches at all, and if they had to come, we said they needed to make an appointment. During times of uncertainty, Chair, and members, it is important that we communicate more regularly to our own employees to give them a sense of direction, a sense of assurance that that we are still in troubled waters, but we are on course. And we also increased our communication with taxpayers, traders and practitioners to make sure that they knew that SARS is not is open for business and that they could and had to fulfill the obligations. And all of this preparation we had to do during the first 100 days of lockdown. And I really at this point, Chair, have to recognize the huge contribution of the leaders at SARS and the people who supported them for being, when most of the country was in lockdown, for stepping up and ensuring that our revenue authority remained functional. This is just the list of the measures. I'm not going to pause there. This is available just as a summary. This is also well publicized. The cost of the revenue measures of 70 billion. We'll be able to account against this once the relief measures have run its course. We had to reconfigure the way we work. As I said, allowed more of our people to work remotely, and where people had to work on site, we introduced rotation schedules for our staff. We introduced appointment visits by for taxpayers. And all the while, we had to remain compliant with public health, occupational health, and social distancing measures. This just gives you a little bit of a mind map of how we said work has to continue, but the way we work has to change. We at the time of the lockdown, had about 3,000 users who had laptops who could go home and log on. Mainly senior managers, but in times like this, it's actually the servicing staff that needs this. So in the period, we had to go from 3,000 to over 9,000 of our staff, almost 80% of our staff, able to work remotely, including areas such as our service channels, debt management, contact centers, processing areas. We also introduced what we call a contact center of one. Contact centers, you will know, are traditionally where you put 100 or 200 or 300 people in a room. They're all connected to their headphones and to the computer systems. We have now completely decentralized our ability, so a contact center agent can actually work from home and be part of a virtual contact center in the same way they ordinarily would have been. And we have just a few, a handful of our contact center agents who have said they still would prefer to come in. But the bottom line is almost 99% of our contact center agents now have the functional capability if need be, to work from home, and many of them are. We did the same thing with branch offices. Almost 1,400 of our branch agents are remotely enabled. We've also introduced for some of them video interviews, so you can sit in the comfort of your home as a taxpayer, and you can dial up as we have today, and you can have a complete interview with SARS, with the SARS agent, resolve everything you need to do while you sit in the comfort of your own home, and a SARS employee is equally sitting in the safety of their house. So this is a remarkable facility that we have created that serves both the health, manage the health risk of our own employees and taxpayers, but also significantly steps up our service offering for this. So you can see, as I said, we have had to ramp up from 13% when the president announced the complete lockdown on the 26th of March, and we currently are at 94%, meaning that most of the staff are able to work wherever they are. It has also cost us 58 million to date, and we plan to spend another 32 million, which of course were money that was not in our budget, but that we have had to allocate some subsequent to COVID announcing itself. In terms of technology enablement, Chair, very pleased to say that we had in double quick time, we built an additional 30 technology and data enhanced functionalities. This allowed, took out over 500,000 transactions which otherwise would have been, would have taken place in our branches, is now able to be performed completely online. In fact, there is very little, if any, reason for a taxpayer to come to our offices because almost all of the functionality is now fully automated, fully digitalized, and there's just a list of some of the things we did, and the use of that has been very encouraging. And of course, during this time, we had to finalize our auto assessment functionality, which we wanted to make available to over 3 million taxpayers, and in the end, we made it available for 3.1 million taxpayers, and then a further just more than 700 additional new registrations that have been coming on board in this financial year, about 500,000 of them also is in the universe of people who qualify for auto assessment. We introduced a new booking system, and I'm pleased to say that that's well on the way. 176,000 taxpayers have used that already, and you'll see that the results of that coming through in a moment. Stepping up our communications internally, did regular video messages to our staff, regular news flashes, personalized letters, communicating what's happening, reassuring people, our staff, that you know, we are together, we are connected, even though we are physically apart. So very important aspect that is generally true, but in times of trouble, even more relevant. Externally, we stepped up our engagement with taxpayers. We had to keep them along what's happening. In the midst of COVID, we had to launch filing season, which I'm pleased to say has been launched with very positive receipt by most people. I hope that the committee members also loved the evocative and deeply emotional messaging in our TV advert. But all of this to remain connected, manage expectations, and ensure continuation of service. Some insights from this year's filing season. We made a few commitments. The first commitment was that we would select more than 3 million taxpayers to participate in the auto assessment. The final number, as I said, is 3.6 million. And I'm very pleased to say that year to date, the 2 million taxpayers which has already filed, about 1,500 of them comes from the auto-assessed population. 92% of those returns were received electronically. Over 1 million of the taxpayers who received the auto-assessment accepted our calculation. Some of them peaked because they were curious and wanted to know how we got there, but in the end they accepted it. And so just more than 400,000 of 1.5, so and that's more than 1 million taxpayers accepted the auto-assessment. 477,000 that would traditionally have filed in branches, we were able to convert, encourage, persuade to convert into electronic filing. That's 1 million taxpayers, and only 86,787 bookings resulted in visits to the branches. Our second, so we have substantially fulfilled that commitment. Our second commitment was that we would give 8 out of every 10 taxpayers an assessment outcome in under 3 seconds. The qualifier there is it depends on the infrastructure, the bandwidth that the taxpayer may have. As you have experienced this morning, some bandwidth is a problem, and it's band narrow and not bandwidth. But even with that, we're very pleased, Chair, to say that more than 8 out of every 10 taxpayers, 85%, who have submitted the assessment, received an assessment outcome in under 5 seconds. That is world class by any standard. Many of the countries who we learned from 10, 15 years ago are now looking at SARS to see how we have made this incredible transition. Our third commitment, very sensitive one, was that we would, for every 7 out of every 10 taxpayers who has a refund that is due, that we would pay that refund within the 72-hour period, unless there is information that they require to give us, then the timing is out of our hand because we then wait on them. But provided everything is available, we will honor this commitment, and I can share with you that more than 9 out of every 10 taxpayers, 91% in fact, have been refunded within 72 hours. Chair, what that means, and this is a good news story for many struggling South Africans, because a lot of these refunds go to people who really live from, you know, with significant resource constraints. What this means is that during lockdown, we were able to pay out 13.5 billion of refunds to 1.24 million taxpayers. That's really, this is the stuff that gives us goosebumps, that we're able to touch the lives of people who really wait for their refunds to be paid because it's the next meal, or the difference between the next meal or sending their kids to bed hungry. Our fourth commitment is the commitment that we will not just ask vague questions. When we need additional information, we will be very specific, and we have honored that commitment substantively. Our fifth commitment is that 7 out of every 10 audits, when an audit is required, will be done within 30 days, or if we're not, we will communicate with you and tell you what the reasons are, so that we can expedite it, and often it is in the hands of the taxpayers. And we can tell you that almost 90% of our audits have been completed within 21 days, other than where we are still waiting on information from taxpayers. So again, we said 70%, we are almost 90%. Our sixth commitment was that we would enforce a lot more swifter and with certainty, which means we will issue letters for late returns, for outstanding returns. We will impose administrative penalties that is prescribed in law. This measure obviously can't be implemented yet because we'll do that as we come to the due dates, and we will report on that later. And the same is true for Commitment 7 and Commitment 8, which are all enforcement measures. But we are very serious, Chair, that we will enforce these measures and we will continue to use the provision in law to name and shame those taxpayers who are convicted and guilty of criminal offences. I think it is, we do this in the interest of honest taxpayers who actually pay their fair share and who honour the obligations. We have to be a lot more firmer on those who choose not to. We remain challenged, Chair, the global and local economic conditions. As Treasury colleagues said earlier on, they will remain subdued for the foreseeable future. Corruption is a disease in our society. You have seen again now with COVID the extent of corruption and often state-assisted corruption, which means it is people who work within government who aid and abet this, which is really a huge tragedy, because not only does it undermine our social fiber and denies taxpayers from goods and services that this money would buy, it also further erodes confidence in SARS and confidence in the government. Low compliance levels remain a challenge for us, and funding constraints, I will flag this as often as I can, because this is really the big concern for us, that we're not able to completely honour our mandate because of a lack of funding. Chair, let me pause there, and I'm very, very happy to take questions of clarity or any other questions the members might have. As I said, I have my colleagues on the line, and if necessary, we'll refer some questions to them.
Okay. Thanks, Commissioner, for the presentation. Members, you can ask questions for clarity or make comments. For now, I can see Dr. George. Dr. George, you can ask the question or make a comment.
Thanks very much, and thanks very much to the Commissioner for the presentation. Always very useful and interesting, and I'm pleased that you're making progress in improving the situation at SARS. I've just got two very brief questions. The first one is about the auto assessments. I have had some people contact me to say that, you know, they were concerned that when they looked at the auto assessments, they found that they should have got a refund or a bigger one, but they hadn't, and they were concerned that if people were not checking it properly, that they were actually being done in some way by SARS. Now, obviously, the key thing is that the onus is on the taxpayer to check that out. But it's probably not an easy question, but I mean, how sure are we how accurate those assessments are? Because sort of some, your average taxpayer might not really understand completely or fully get it. So they're assuming that, okay, SARS is sending it to me, it is therefore credible and therefore it won't be wrong. So I'm just wondering if you've had any experience on that, because I've certainly had some people mentioning that or contacting me about that and being concerned. That's the one item. And then the other one is that I have had some personal experience on the difficulty in opening letters from SARS. You know, I was told, move it to your desktop and open it up. And I've battled. I never battled with anything other than opening letters from SARS. Now, I believe that something is being done about that, but I certainly know of a number of people are saying, SARS writes you a letter and you just can't get the thing open. So I don't know if that's an issue and whether that's being addressed. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. George. It will be Mrolong Kosana Shibambu. Honorable Mrolong.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. I think the first one is that the commitment to pay a refund within 72 hours is commendable. It gives concrete expression to, you know, the characteristics of good tax, of simplicity, of efficiency, but also of certainty. I, however, I have two questions, Chair. the slide 25, and I'm talking about the presentation that was emailed to us, you know, indicates that, you know, for the public confidence to be restored on SARS, one of the things that must happen is that a national treasury must be in a position to provide adequate resources to SARS. Now, I would have wanted the commissioner to give a proper elaboration on what those adequate resources are from national treasury and whether they do not get these resources from the national treasury. You know, the outbreak of COVID and subsequent ban on sales of tobacco has exposed us to the magnitude of illegal or illicit tobacco trade. I wanted to know whether SARS has had an opportunity to make a proper reflection on the need to heighten its fight against illicit tobacco trade. Thank you.
Thanks, Ndono. Tony, what's going on?
No, no, we welcome the presentation by the commissioner of SARS. One, the issue that just been raised by Dr. George on the auto assessment of the personal income tax. I just want to ask on the communication side as to how far did the communication went in terms of making taxpayers aware of this particular initiative, because I think it was a pretty new initiative that was not there before. And well, I also know quite a number of people who were confused by this thing. I know a person who saw a message that says there's an X amount of money appear in the SMS. The person thought that it's an amount that is due to him, and he accepted it, and only to find out later that in actual fact that X amount is the amount that is due to SARS. So he had to go and start a new process of launching a dispute when he has in fact accepted earlier. So I think that's the confusion that is there about this particular system. And I think questions that people are asking is to say, but where does SARS get this information? Because this auto-assessment is happened even before people could submit their IRP-5, their medical tax certificate, their logbooks, and all those things, but then they get this message. So I think it created a lot of confusion, I think, to taxpayers. So I'm just checking on the part of communication, because I think if you are introducing something new, I think it needs to be communicated thoroughly for people to know it and to understand, to alleviate mistakes, so that people don't accept when they are not supposed to accept, or reject when they are in actual fact supposed to accept. People must fully understand the system, so that when they accept, they accept something that they understand. And if they opt not to accept and go and fight, they do that having a thorough understanding. It was like also in the presentation it appeared that there are people who did not accept, but later they could not provide a new information which is contrary to that auto assessment. I think this whole thing, I think in my view, is created by the fact that people did not understand this particular system. So it all goes back to the issue of communication. How far do you communicate to make sure that if you introduce a new system, taxpayers, they really know it and really understand it. Secondly, on the issue of your debt book, which is for 2019-2020, standing at about 177 billion rand. I want to know what plans you have as far in dealing with this debt book, because it's really not good if it's standing at 177 billion rand. Well, the last question under outcome 5, on the acquisition spend, I see that there's about 11.6%.
Kosan. Musoli, Kosan.
Okay. Do you think is it enough that this is a percentage that should go to these different sectors of our society from the bigger case that SARS is having? Thanks, Honorable Chief.
Thanks, Mr. Honorable Bambu.
No, thank you very much, Chair. I'm sure you noticed that as a component of the overall revenue collected, the company income tax is gradually declining as a company. So if you were to check 5-6 years ago, PIT, VAT, and CIT would almost have similar levels of contribution into the overall revenue collected. But now, the company income taxes constitute 16% of the overall revenue collected. I think there's something wrong about that. And part of what could be wrong will be SARS' inability to deal with what we spoke about in the 5th Parliament on the issue of the aggressive tax avoidance. And there seem to be no clear and believable measures that are being implemented by SARS to deal with aggressive tax avoidance, mostly by the multinational companies. And of course, advised by these huge audit firms, which are involved in bloating of expenses without the general pay taxes in South Africa. And I'm sensing a worrying justification from the commissioner on why company income taxes must not be maximally collected, because the resources must be available for something else. Those who do business in South Africa must pay tax maximally. It's their obligation that they reach when they get to invest here. So maybe to delve deeper into that, Chair, we need to be given broad categories without disclosing the names of the taxpayers. Can we be given broad categories of just how much revenue did you collect from mining? How much revenue did you collect from the financial services sector, from agriculture, from all these sectors of the economy? And I'm sure we'll then begin to realize how certain sectors are not paying taxes at all when they are generating a maximum profit. Just how much tax is being paid by the retail sector? Can we be given those deeper breakdowns in terms of what happened? How much tax was collected from the digital economy? What is SARS capable to collect taxes from the digital and e-commerce businesses in a manner that is much more believable? Because the fact of the matter is that business is now is moving out of the brick and mortar phenomenon to the e-commerce spaces. What is SARS plan and adaptation to this reality of e-commerce? What are they doing to collect that and all the income taxes that are earned in the e-commerce space? And Chair, this is a worrying trend, and I detected that with the Minister of Finance, that every time there is incompetences or shortfalls in terms of what is targeted, they always point to state capture. Can the Commissioner tell us what exactly has state capture done to this capacity in El Sabna? Tell us the specifics, so that if there are issues that must be referred to the Commission, or issues that have to be dealt with much more differently, we know what to do. Instead of a broad statement, can you tell us the specifics of how state capture and digital capacity to collect revenue? I'm not convinced about that currently, but let's listen, maybe something believable will come out in the responses.
Are you done, Honorable Guzman?
I'm done, Chair.
Okay. Thanks. Commissioner, those are the questions and the comments from members. But if the DG and the Deputy Minister would like to comment, because SARS is an entity of treasury, they are also welcome.
Chair, so thank you for the questions. Member George and Skosana asked questions on the auto assessment, so I'd like to just comment on that quickly, Chair. So firstly, the auto assessment outcome is a function of the third party data that we are able to get from the employers, the so-called IRP5 data, plus the information from banks on financial statements, interest earnings, from retirement funds, pension fund administrators, which speaks to contributions towards pension funds, and medical aid mostly. So one of the things that we have highlighted earlier on is SARS has let itself down very badly in the past by in some way not doing enough to address pay-as-you-earn non-compliance. These are employers who collect money from their employees, and some of them do not pay it over to SARS. These are employees who do not submit the monthly statement, which is called an EMP 201, but it's just a reconciliation statement between the money they've collected from their employers and the money that they then hand over to SARS. This is just a reconciliation statement. And then twice a year, an employer is required to also submit a half yearly and a full yearly statement, or what is called as an EMP 501. If that information is not correct, then we cannot perform an auto assessment. So in selecting the universe, we were fairly confident that that universe of taxpayers, their salary structure was standard enough and we could obtain the third party information. What had happened is that just before the auto assessment went live, we had a few large employers who updated the third party information, which meant that there was a discrepancy between the information that was in the SMS and the information that was live on our system. The information live on our system is always correct and the most recent. And so if a person opened the SMS, let's just say on day one, because remember the first SMSs went out towards the end of July, a few days ahead of the 1st of August when it officially opened, and the time they log on, and if that employer updated the information, then the actual result will be based on the latest information and not the information in the SMS. So that's Dr. George, part of the reason why there was a discrepancy. But it doesn't mean that the result on our core system was incorrect. We are pretty confident that the algorithm does the calculation is correct, and if the information is up to date, the outcome is exactly the same outcome as the taxpayer would have had. So that's the first point. With the wisdom of hindsight, we should not have sent out an SMS with a number in it. We should have just, the SMS should just have told the taxpayer, you have been selected for auto assessment. If you want to see your result, please log on to your mobile app or your e-filing, and if you're happy with the outcome. And that's one area where in trying to be too helpful, we actually weren't helpful. And so we fall on our swords in terms of that. We will address that going forward. Not to put in a number, which as Member Skosana also says, which clearly was not clear enough. Can we do more communication around this? Absolutely. I don't think we can ever say we've done enough communication. And the fact that there was confusion early on just is the best feedback we can ever ask for that we can. But I think that has to be seen in the context of the overwhelming success when more than a million people of 1.48 million people, just 1.5 million people, more than two-thirds of them, in fact, have agreed with our outcome. Even where they may not have liked it, where they may have expected a refund, but they had to pay in, at the end of the day, they agreed with our outcome. Those who didn't agree, the system has been built to allow a taxpayer to submit any additional information to us. So here's an example. Some taxpayers may have expenses which has not gone through the payroll of a medical nature. We would not have that, and so that's why the functionality is built to allow taxpayers to upload the additional information, and it's perfectly permissible. We will verify that, and if we agree, the assessment is done. So just over 400,000 of the 1.5 million taxpayers decided to edit or upload additional information. There's nothing strange about it. It simply is the way that the system was built. So we are very confident to the members who have asked this question that the auto-assessment works, and those little niggles in front will have been ironed out, and the final resort of a taxpayer is to come to our offices if they need to, or to phone our contact centers, and we will also assist them in a virtual way. I will ask Mr. King on later on, when I'm done, to talk about the opening of letters and what we are doing about that. To the question, I think that was asked by Member Morolong, the funding of SARS. I'd like later on for the DG of Treasury to also give a perspective. But over the last number of years, there has been a steady decline of, and even in the current year, there is a reduction in the number of spend. We have, just as a short-term measure, we have indicated to the Minister and to Treasury that the kind of skills we need now urgently are more data scientists, data analysts, skilled in specialized auditors and investigators, IT security, and those are some of the core areas. The point that that Mr. Shivambu makes later on about our own ability to respond to those areas of aggressive tax planning is significantly impacted by the quality or lack thereof in areas of transfer pricing, base erosion, and profit shifting. But I'll come back to that later on. On the tobacco and excise, Chair, what I would we would welcome the opportunity to come back to the committee when the committee has time. I think that the illicit economy and the area that was raised by Mr. Shivambu warrants a detailed presentation rather than just a quick response from me now. And in such a detailed presentation, we are just wrapping up the work, as I said earlier, on of the tax gap. The tax gap addresses two significant areas. The first area is aggressive tax planning, those areas that that the member points out, of taxes in mining, taxes in the retail sector, taxes in finance sector, where we look at things like the effective tax rate versus the statutory tax rate. And the further there is a deviation between a effective rate and a statutory rate says that there's something that is wrong. There's possibly areas of aggressive avoidance or even areas of evasion. There's a lot of concern that I've expressed before
that, you know, when it gets to companies moving their tax base offshore by all kinds of transfer pricing arrangements, we have seen a significant increase since 2015 of areas where, and that has a long-term impact, as Mr. Shivambu quite rightly points out, of eroding our tax base and having long-term negative consequences for South Africa. So that requires a detailed presentation. On the digital economy, there's two issues. The one is a matter which is still up for discussion, which has not yet been concluded, which is moving the primary principle, members would know, the primary basis for determining taxing rights by a country is physical presence or residency. And at the moment, as the digital economy is becoming more virtual, physical presence is no longer the relevant nexus between activity and taxing rights. What the proposal is to move to economic presence rather than physical presence, and that's a discussion to which South Africa, with the involvement of National Treasury and SARS, is intimately involved to try and shape that. There appear to be no issue with changing the nexus from physical presence to economic activity. The big issue is the allocation principles, how much of the tax is in fact allocated to the country where the mothership or the main head office company sits versus where the economic activity sits. So that's one area of area, but that's not yet resolved. On the issue of other digital taxes, at the moment, consumption taxes, the VAT, has been digitalized in South Africa for a number of years. I think there was a parliamentary question that we, in fact, responded to fully, but we can cover that again. If we come back to the debt management that Member Skosana raised, I think there I mentioned in my presentation this is a huge area of concern. I mentioned two things. The one is the way we account for it. That's not really within our hands. That is a compliance issue, but it does require significant investment in our systems in order to move from cash accounting to gap accounting for all of our tax types. And then the second concern that I raised is we just have not been as efficient as we needed to be in terms of the way we manage our overall debt, the way debt is aged, and that is a subject of an in-year review where we have fundamentally changed the way we manage debt. And as I said in my presentation, hopefully when we report on this year, we can come back and talk to some progress that we have made in that regard. Notwithstanding that, every year the contributions to our debt management efforts amounts to somewhere around about 50 billion rand. But we can still do a lot more. I'm going to ask when I'm done our CFO, Yolanda van Merwe, to talk about our procurement spend across those areas. And then I will come back to talk about the last point around state capture. So let me hand over to Mark. By the way, the revenue shortfall issue, SARS has consistently said we are underfunded by an amount of 800 million a year. Let me hand over to Mark to talk about difficulties even I have when I open a document on my iPad. So it is often device related, but also tell you what we are doing there. And Yolanda to talk about acquisition spend
I will then defer to the Deputy Minister and the DG to talk about the funding of SARS, and then I will close, Chair, with making some comments around state capture.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Chair and Mr. George. Just to your question with regards to this, it is often related to being on an Apple device. I think as the Commissioner has indicated, he's had challenges in opening some of the documents. We are fully aware of it and trying to make it multi-platform compatible, in other words, across all platforms that are out there. Of course, it's way beyond just Apple, which operates on Safari, and Microsoft on a different one, and obviously Adobe operates also on the Android devices. So we are looking to improve it. Just with regards to the Forms Commissioner, just to give them feedback that we are moving our forms to HTML5, that they are across all platforms, that they are available, and it does not require to have a specific browser to look at that. We will look at the specific example in this instance, but there are isolated cases from the call center. We are hearing that it is not a big problem currently. Thank you, Chair.
I will move to Ms. van der Merwe, and then also maybe Johnston can add to the procurement. He was the CFO and responsible procurement in the period under review. So Yolandi and then Johnston.
Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning to all the SCOF members and the SARS leadership. So I think the Commissioner already touched on the reasons why we've not spent all as we intended to. We set quite high targets for ourselves in the qualifying small enterprises as well as the exempted micro enterprises area due to the fact that if you look at the SARS budget, about 90 to 95% is fixed. It leaves very little room to actually spend in these specific areas. Like the Ministry Commission has indicated, our staffing cost is about 75%, and our physical footprint and our IT footprint is about another 20%. So when SARS needs to reduce budget, logically it's in the variable space, which is the balance of 5%. We've done very good in the black women-owned enterprise space. We've exceeded the target significantly there, but we fell short in the other areas. So I would just request Johnston to elaborate on to the other two areas where we set our targets and did not achieve them. So thank you, Commissioner, and to the Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you, Yolandi, and greetings to the committee members and the Chairperson. Yolandi has widely covered it. We looked at entities less than 10 million and 10 over, exempted micro enterprises, and we had an aspiration of shifting our expenditure towards those entities. However, because of constraints in expenditure growth or budget growth, we were not able to necessarily shift spend to benefit those entities. But also, I think it's important to indicate to the members that SARS has generally taken a much stricter definition of EMV and QSE, where the numbers that you see reflect EMEs and QSEs that are 50+1% black owned. And that generally would be much stricter than the normal 10-over-based classification of those entities. So the numbers we are referring here or reporting here are on a structure, a narrower definition of EMEs and QSEs, which is 50+1% black owned businesses. And the 3% that we are reflecting in each of the categories is the actual external expenditure that has been spent with those particular entities. We, of course, seek and look for opportunities to improve, even in the current year and subsequent years within the MSF, across the EME and the QSE environment. We must also indicate that some entities that would have helped to support the EME in prior years, They may have gone on to get additional government business in some instances and would have reached the 10 million when 10 over, therefore growing, which means we can't then claim them as EMEs, which then enables them to fill up space, which would generally necessitate that then you participate in supplier development activities, which we put in because of our budget constraints in the year under review. Chair, that's the explanation I would have wanted to give on the particular matter. Thank you. Maybe Commissioner, if Commissioner, I just maybe deal with the CIT issue that we said.
Yes, please. I was going to say, continue with that, please.
I think in the detailed annual report, we do show our CIT performance. But I think to answer the question directly, we have seen in the year under review on CIT particularly, quite encouraging performance, which is up year on year by 11% from the mining industry. The member would recall that we saw quite a buoyant market in terms of the PBMs group in the mining space, where the prices for palladium in particular and a bit of rhodium increased quite drastically in the last quarter. And we saw a windfall from the mining sector in as far as contribution to the total amount of CIC collected. And as I indicate, we saw a year-on-year growth from that particular sector, being the mining sector, growing by 11%. There were specific questions around financial services. Year on year, we saw a contraction of 1.6% in terms of the contribution to CIT. And again, we understand in this particular space that the contraction mainly was driven by IFRS 9, and at the banks we're looking at writing off some of the bad debt that they would have picked up. And we saw this slight contraction of 1.6. In as far as the wholesale and retail trade is concerned, we saw again another contraction here of 1.8% year on year. And this is driven by a number of things the Commissioner would have spoken earlier around consumption, as most households were battling with debt and the servicing of the debt, and consumer confidence was generally lower. And therefore, the wholesale sector would have seen some challenging times in the year under review. And we see that marginal 1.8 contraction to be pointing towards that particular environment. Commissioner, I'm sure when we provide a detailed, finalized report in this specific page, the view will be given. There has been quite a number of interventions that under the Davis Tax Committee we have initiated. International taxes have been one of those. And in particular, we have looked at services between related entities, mostly multinationals, and we have initiated work in terms of sending letters of request for information to about 1,240 entities around that particular segment of taxpayers. And again, this is an indication that we want to get into an understanding of the transfers that happen between these multinationals. Commissioner, let me end there around the issues of corporate income tax. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Johnston. Just for the members who may not know, Johnston was, in the year that we are reporting on, was the Chief Financial Officer. He has subsequently moved to take on a newly formed and very important role in SARS. So Johnston is our Chief Revenue Officer, responsible for leading a program that will ensure the focused revenue recovery, but also just a better rhythm to the daily, weekly, and monthly revenue program and activities. Just on the last question, which relates to the state capture. So I can really talk for a long time on state capture. The first is to acknowledge that state capture at SARS was real, and that whatever Judge Nugent reported in his report, which is a matter of public record, is not only true, but it is the actual breakdown at SARS has been significantly more severe than what even the report describes it. I say that unequivocally, and I say that without fear of contradiction. And having spent now just more than a year and a bit there, I have confirmed that every day. Let me give a few examples of that. In terms of just capacity, inappropriate leadership appointments were made where people did not have the requisite experience to take up some of those roles and were yet expected to perform at those roles. There were questions of integrity around some of the decisions that were taken. Those decisions are well publicized and, in fact, in most instances, uncontested. So there's no question about the impact of leadership on any organization. So SARS suffered a significant negative impact on leadership. And part of the leadership rebuilding work is seeking to address that. The second is that for a number of reasons, SARS has seen a significant exodus of over 2,000 people. And as I pointed out in my presentation, more than 50% of those people were people who were specialized auditors, about 115 of them, that were in the large business center talking about those areas, the very areas that Mr. Shivambu raises as areas where we need to step up our capability, especially for companies, international and local companies who play the game of aggressive planning, but also over 200 debt collectors and other investigative orders. Well over 1,000 of those people had left the organization, and a lot of them because they felt they lost confidence in the organization, some of them directly impacted and disconnected from the organization and moved on, and some of them will argue that they have been forced out of the organization. On governance and integrity, the need for an organization like SARS to have a focused integrity unit and anti-corruption unit to manage the behavior of and the integrity of its own staff cannot be overstated. And there are many examples of breaches of integrity of audits that were commenced but never completed because there was a decision by a senior executive to discontinue an audit, and senior executives should not be involved in those decisions. The Commissioner of SARS is not involved in case selection and is never involved on his or her own to settle outstanding debts with taxpayers. Those practices were real and they were prevalent at SARS during this period. They are unarguable and uncontestable, and the traces thereof is visible. We suffered as a result in procurement practices and recruitment practices, which were questionable, and some of which was the subject of review. Let me name a few of them. The Bain operating model review, not only the way it was procured, but the outcome of its procurement, of its advice, was the most visible example thereof. But there was also Grant Thornton, there was the KPMG review. There's a whole lot of reviews that have become public knowledge that have done more damage to SARS in undermining its integrity, and those things are uncontestable. Then there was the dismantling of core capability, the large business center, the high net worth individual, the way that case selection was often influenced and done. Again, the evidence thereof is throughout the organization. And I think one must not underestimate, Chair and members, that SARS depends on a highly engaged workforce that has trust in its leadership and has confidence with a high morale. We have currently just completed the first phase of a listening campaign where individual staff members share with us how their careers were impacted, how they were marginalized, how they were treated during this time, and some of this sadly was in the public domain, well publicized, and I can tell you a lot of these to various degrees has merit and substance. And so, Chair, I think by questioning the extent of the impact, that is understandable. But none of us around the table can argue that there wasn't state capture exercise, that the impact was not real, and that it will, in fact, the impact is unquantifiable and will take significant effort, additional resources, and time to rebuild. Thank you, Chair. I don't know if the Deputy Minister or the DG wants to add to some of the questions.
It looks like Honourable Shibambo would like to make a follow-up question or a comment.
No, Chair, the only thing that I've said before is the please make it
Sorry, Chair, I couldn't hear the question.
Honourable Shibambo, if you can repeat yourself, your voice was not clear this side.
I was saying, Chair, that can you be given a breakdown of the CIG, like in terms of the sectors, like, can we have that? I think it's in writing, can we get that?
Okay.
Chair, thank you. I heard the question. We will respond in the next few days.
Okay.
But Chair, I still I think to the more other dimensions that was part of the first part of the question, we would be happy after the tax gap review is finalized to come back to the committee and to do a detailed presentation on the areas of concern we have with the illicit economy and also areas of aggressive tax planning and what we intend to do with that. So, but I leave that to you, Chair, but we make the offer.
And Chair, can you kind of get a clearer perspective on what is going to be done with the e-commerce? Because we can't just say that the current law says it's got to do a lot.
Okay.
Chair, we have responded to that question in detail. I can reissue the response to that to all members. But I that is continuing work, and I'm happy in the presentation that I am proposing that we cover a specific section also on the digitalization of economies.
Okay, thanks. But the DG wants to say something before we move.
Yes, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I'm just going to comment on the funding of SARS, which the Commissioner repeatedly mentioned in his presentation. Firstly, maybe let me take the committee through what, you know, the biggest reduction in the SARS budget came just after the Fees Must Fall campaign, after government decided to go on that route when we, but in excess of R1 billion or R1.5 billion was then deducted or reduced, the SARS budget was reduced that year. And after it was reduced, it was mainly informed by the fact that across the whole of the state, all departments were being cut, including SARS, including many, many other departments. So now you take R1.5 billion at one go. And at the time, you know, we had compelling reasons why we had to do that. Part of the issues were that SARS was running huge cash balance at the time. We were not sure that the money was being used appropriately. This was a few years ago. So we had a compelling case to cut, and that cut then obviously continued till today in terms of the impact. Now, the call that the SARS has made consistently that they are underfunded, it is true. It is true because of that initial cut, because when we reset the budget in SARS, obviously, and SARS starting to do new programs, new interventions, you really then feel that or see that there is a need for funding. But it is difficult to just maybe give SARS that $1.5 billion or R1 billion back immediately without factoring it in over a number of years. For the following reasons. One is that, the economy has not been doing well. The tax collection has not been what it is. We've consistently, in the last couple of years, revising revenue targets downwards every year, including what you see now, with the $300 billion that I was talking about in my earlier presentation, which is a huge impact in this. Now, effectively, it means you're on the revenue side, you're running short. And as an entity of the state or a department or a state or a public entity, then you obviously, and the government takes, not Treasury, it must be clear, Commissioner must be very clear that it is not us. He consistently says Treasury is cutting the budget. No. We make recommendations to the Minister's Committee on the budget, and Cabinet takes a decision in terms of the funding and the allocation. So it ceases to be a Treasury process. It's a government-wide cabinet decision that decides and then recommends a budget. And then the budget is presented in Parliament. So Treasury is not cutting anybody, but Treasury can make recommendations. In the last few years, we have not been adding any cent to any department. Instead, we've been cutting. There's an argument which I agree with that is, if you give SARS more money, they'll be able to collect more. No problem. Agreed. But there's no money. And the challenge that we're having is that the ask in the system is too huge. The ask in the system from various entities, whether you speak to the SIU today, they'll tell you that they are underfunded. You speak to the NPA, they tell you they're underfunded. You speak to SARS, you speak to FIC. I'm choosing those four entities because we know their capacity, if they do well and they do well in terms of their work, we should be able to get more money, whether it's assets that belong to the states and they need to be recovered, etc., and the work that must be done. If you speak to the police, they need money. If you speak to the defense, they need money. If you speak to Treasury, we have obligations in terms of intern. So the system chair with this understanding has to permeate through into the SARS system and SARS senior leadership. It's not us just deciding one morning that we can just simply give SARS R1 billion or R800 million. So we expect, and this is an unfortunate call that I'm making, we expect with the mega resources that everyone has to make good of what we have. And I can tell you, Chair, if there's an opportunity that is availing itself to fund SARS more, I would be the first one to do that because I was the one who presided over the cut of the R1.5 billion in a few years ago. And I knew what it meant at the time and the impact we can see. So, yes, unless such time that Mincombat is meeting again this afternoon, I'll tell Mincombat between 2 and 6 today that these are the preliminary allocations, this is the impact. I don't want to go into other details around, for instance, cuts that we have to make now. We have to cut throughout again in the system. And if we take a view that says every department of the state should be impacted, maybe SARS should be the least impacted in terms of the cuts. Then we have to ensure that and eventually make sure that we protect further erosion of SARS budget. But the two things I'm mentioning, Chair, is that it is not us, the National Treasury, who continuously cut SARS. No. We'll make recommendations. It's the realities that we find ourselves on the ground. And the second point is that with the mega resources that are there in SARS will have to just make do of what they have, unfortunately, which if I wanted, I would have given them more. But we don't have the system. And then the call that we consistently made is that
We are running out of money. There's no money in the state. This is a fact. Unless you have to write huge deficits. Already I did mention this morning that we are projected to be 6.9. We are thinking it's going to be double digit. It was 14.9 at the time of the supplementary budget. It will hover around there, especially the further impact of the erosion of growth in the economy, which effectively means you are collecting less, effectively means then we must then reduce budgets across the system. The key question will be, which I've consistently pushed, including in medium-term expenditure committee, that I chair, that colleagues, let's protect institutions like STARS, let's give more to institutions like the NDPP, because they're doing sterling work that must actually start to show fruit. But unfortunately, if there's no money, the system is clogged. And as it is, Chair, the system is right clogged. And we would have wanted a situation where SARS gets more. But we have to support them with anything. If any savings accrues or any new funding opportunity comes, SARS obviously will be first in the line, because with extra sand, they'll be able to collect more. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Deputy Minister, any comment before we close?
No, thanks, Chair and honourable members and colleagues. Two comments. The first one is with regard to the issue that Honourable Shivambo has raised on the taxing of the digital economy. And the second one is just to underscore the point that DG has made and everyone has made with regard to the challenge of low economic growth in raising tax revenue. So, because I think this is very important to understand what we're up against in raising tax revenue and other economic goals. Now, we all know, at the risk of stating the obvious, that the economic growth has been low for more than 10 years now. And this has been worsened by both the pre-COVID technical recession and the COVID-19 itself. And this has not only negatively impacted on the tax revenue, but the number of unemployed people has increased from 12 million to 14 million. We've got 14 million people who are unemployed now. And now we also know that economic growth is a function of, amongst other things, business spending, investment. And business spending has been very low, as shown by the Business Confidence Index results. So what it means is that because business is not spending, it's not investing, it means that we are not creating jobs, we are not setting the material basis for the tax revenue. And part of the reason why business has not been spending, has not been investing, is because of the unreliable supply of water, electricity provision. And it's for this reason that we're working hard to ensure that we restore business confidence through structural reforms. And during the MTBPS in October, the minister will report on the progress that we are making insofar as the structural reforms are concerned. Now, economic growth also requires government spending, and unfortunately, the quality of our government expenditure has not been producing growth. Spending on ailing SOEs is not quality spending. Spending on corruption is not quality spending, because corruption does divert resources from economic growth activities and servicing the poor. Now, in order to spend, government obviously has to generate revenue through taxation in addition to borrowing. So building the institutional capacity of SARS is very important, and therefore the financial support to SARS should be understood in that context. And it's for that reason that we support the commissioner and his team in making sure that they strengthen this institutional capacity of SARS to generate revenue for the state, in order for the state to serve the South Africans. Now, on the issue that Honorable Shivambo has raised on taxing the digital economy, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, I think the Commissioner has stated how VAT regulations were revised to deal with electronic services. The regulations also make provisions for intermediaries such as Amazon and eBay to register as VAT vendors themselves. But I think we need a global and a continental wide approach to taxing the digital economy. The issue of taxing the digital economy is on the global agenda as part of the base erosion and profit shifting action points. Unfortunately, Africa has no common approach on this matter. Other regions in the world are better organized in this regard. We are working with African Tax Administration Forum under the leadership of Mr. Logan Watt, the Executive Secretary, to place the matter on the digital economy so far as taxing it is concerned on the African Union agenda. And therefore, we will urge our representatives at the Pan-African Parliament to also place the issue of taxing the digital economy on the agenda of the Pan-African Parliament of the African Union. Because, like I said, other regions have a much, much better approach on this issue. And therefore, in dealing with this issue within the national space, like in our case, I do want to urge Honorable Shivambu and other honorable members and our representatives in the Pan-African Parliament to really place this matter on taxing the digital economy on the African agenda so that we have a continentally wide approach on this matter so that when we engage other region, OECD, and others, at least there's a common perspective and a common program and policy program insofar as this issue is concerned. To leave it only to Mr. Logan Watt and his team in the African Tax Administration Forum is not sufficient. It does require the political support of all of us who are bestowed with the responsibility of leading institutions in Africa. Chair, I really want to express my sincere appreciation to taxpayers who are compliant because they really help us in enabling us to generate revenue so that we can continue to serve South Africans, grow the economy. But I also wish to thank yourself, Chair, and the committee members for continuous guidance in managing the finance of this country, but also in raising revenue to serve South Africans better. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much, Deputy Minister Dr. Masondo. The DG of Treasury, the Commissioner SARS, members of Parliament who are also members of this committee, officials. Thanks for the briefing. And we believe that all what you are raising should actually be turned into action. Which will have an impact on the lives of our people. As you have said, Dr. Masson, unemployment is growing, and it looks like we'll never meet our NDP target. It doesn't look like, because instead of going in the right direction, unemployment, inequality, poverty, is the skyrocketing. And something has to be done in this regard. Instead of the economy growing, is declining. We witnessed the report coming from SSA that indicate that, as you have said, that more than 2 million people have lost jobs. This also means that there's going to be a huge decline in terms of personal income tax bracket, and which will have a serious impact on the social grants and other expenditure items in the social space, which makes a difference in the lives of our people. 2 million is a very big number. Within this space of time, end of March and beginning of October, surely I don't know how that will be mitigated, because the decline of GDP might grow. And we believe that, as we have raised this matter before, that we can't always be on the problem statement. There should come a time when government, probably through Treasury, should present to us as public representatives a turnaround economic inclusive strategy that will enable government, business, and labor to participate actively in rebuilding the economy. I heard the other time that there was a NEDLAC forum. I'm not sure what was agreed on there. Probably at some stage, you will share with this committee what was agreed at NEDLAC. The situation is very bad. When I go to post offices to do other business, the lines or the queues there of people who are